It's a pleasure to be here to talk, and what I'd like to do, as the sign says, is to talk about the work that we have been doing on a very large group of transcriptional regulators called the basic helix, loop helix family. I want to give two talks. The one today has to do with pretty much the overall picture of evolution of this large group of transcriptional regulators, some modular aspects of this. And then tomorrow, I think David Pollack and I are talking sort of in tandem, and I'll talk about amino acid covariation and how it affects structure and function. The talks that I'm going to give will be sort of an effort to summarize the big picture with regard to some issues about the evolution of a very large group of transcriptional regulators. It'll be much less about generalized methodologies. It will be trying to understand how evolution happens in a large group of proteins. Before I do that, I want to do some advertising for one of our members today. There is a symposium being held at my university next Friday in honor of Walter Fitch. Walter is being given an honorary degree by my university, which I think is very appropriate that the state of North Carolina would give an evolutionary biologist. I've organized several creationists to introduce you. But anyway, if you should happen to be in North Carolina next week, please come by. It should be a very nice symposium. It's a truism in biology that the evolution of complex structures, and by complex structures I generally mean morphological sorts of things, but the evolution of such complex structures arises through evolutionary changes in the developmental processes that underlie these complex structures. And in turn, the evolution of these developmental processes results from heritable changes in patterns of gene expression. And so we need to go quite early in the cascade from DNA to proteins to understand where transcription fits. The control of gene expression occurs at the level, early on at the level of transcription, by mediated very much by a group of proteins called transcription factors that interact with DNA to control both gene activity and also all the subsequent developmental processes, the events and the processes that regulate development in very much a dynamic, continuum sort of way. There are a number of families or classes or groups or whatever you want to call them of transcriptional regulators. You've heard of a lot of these. There are things called zinc fingers, helix turn helix, helix loop helix, steroid receptors, basic leucine zippers. There's a large number of these, but they all do very similar sorts of things. They all seem to bind DNA and facilitate protein-protein interactions, so-called dimerizations. And what this suggests is that the regulation of transcription and the regulation of gene expression has been solved a number of times in the evolution of life using slightly different sorts of processes, different sorts of proteins, and so forth. So all of these have functional similarities, but they don't necessarily have sequence similarities. So it's obvious that there's some convergence going on here, and that things are being fixed or solved in quite different sorts of ways. No, it's not. It's the same sort of process, but it's a different mechanism of going about it. Some attributes of all these transcription factor families are that most of the proteins contain multiple independently derived, separately evolved sort of domains. I sort of put this little picture up here to show you a symbolic element of a multi-domain protein. And so what you get when you have these families of transcriptional regulators is you get what are often sort of functionally heterogeneous proteins that are clustered together because they share one of these domains. They share a domain that's involved with DNA binding or with oligomerization or these sorts of things. So what this does, of course, is it presents some difficulties for trying to do evolutionary sorts of studies, because we often think, or at least the people that work on transcriptional regulators often think, that a group of proteins might be monophyletic if they contain one of these small conserved functional domains, like the DNA binding dimerization domain. But multi-domain proteins, as I tried to show you in that little graphic before, often share several different highly conserved domains, and I'll show you several of these later on today. And each one of them, each of these little domains usually has an independent evolutionary history, and they may occur in different unrelated sorts of proteins. So you may have leucine zippers spread over a large number of different types of proteins. Almost every group of transcriptional regulators has a leucine zipper protein in it somewhere. And so if you classified proteins based on the presence of a leucine zipper, then you would put all these together and say that they're a monophyletic family, which in fact is not true, because leucine zippers, which simply refer to a heptad repeat of leucines over a particular amount of amino acids, are pretty easily derived independently. It's been shown by Sam Carlin and others that it's quite easy to derive independently a leucine zipper protein.
So you would use leucine zipper as an example, not one module that's been sort of duplicated and shuffled around, but rather...
Well, I will do this. I will show it to you as a module. And I'm just going to call a module some functional unit in this case, and try not to say anything about its evolutionary history, because as you'll see in a little bit, there are a lot of different sorts of modules that that occur. They tend to be more functional components in my definition. So what I want to do today give you a brief introduction to some aspects of these basic helix-loop-helix proteins. I want to talk about what constitutes a basic helix-loop-helix domain. In other words, how do you define this family? Talk a little bit about the evolution of that domain, and then in the end talk about some very new work that Walter and I are doing on the evolution of something called a Micmax MAD Paddywhack Give a Dog a Bone transcription network. Every time I say Micmax MAD, it reminds me of the kids' Paddywhack Give a Dog a Bone thing. So, basic helix-loop-helix proteins are a large, functionally diverse group of transcriptional regulators that control gene expression in many different fundamental pathways of many groups of organisms. They regulate transcription through DNA binding and protein-protein dimerization. This is a cartoon showing a protein called Fol4 out of yeast. It's a phosphate-based sort of protein, phosphate metabolism. So this is the DNA helix. This is a dimer showing two monomer units here, showing the DNA binding component, so that there's an alpha helix, a loop, and a second alpha helix. And so what happens is that there's DNA binding here, and there's dimerization among the protein elements here.
Is that homodimer?
That's sort of drawn as a heterodimer. You get both homodimers and heterodimers out of this. And I'll talk quite a bit about this a little later. But there are some proteins that don't have a DNA binding domain. So for example, I could draw you a similar picture of a heterodimer where one monomer, would not have this component here. And these proteins often act as dominant negative regulators. In other words, they will dimerize with another protein, but they will inhibit DNA binding because of that. There's several very well-known examples. A thing called an inhibitor of differentiation is one, so-called ID proteins. So these things, as I said, they're functionally quite important. They do a lot of different things. Rather than put protein family names up there, I've decided to put functions to tell you what they're involved in. Many of the proteins are involved in some way in cell proliferation. A number of them, as I've indicated here, are proto-oncogenes. In other words, they're genes that have the potentiality of causing cancers and tumors. A lot of them are involved in cell differentiation, muscle development, nerve development. Another class involved with circadian rhythms, lineage differentiation, sex differentiation. This is a very important protein involved with dioxin metabolism. In plants, there are things that are involved with anthocyanin pigmentation. So they're a diverse group. They have a lot of different sorts of functions. They all have this basic helix-loop-helix domain. And the domain is actually evolutionarily quite ancient. It occurs in plants, yeast, fungi, all sorts of animals. The domain itself is bipartite. It has a DNA binding component, which is this part down in here, which is an alpha helix. It also has a hydrophobic dimerization region that's really two amphipathic alpha helices. Amphipathic means that there are alternating hydrophobic, hydrophilic regions in an alpha helix. And these two alpha helices are separated by a variable length loop. The loop can range in terms of number of amino acids from 4 to somewhere around 60. We find some yeasts with very long loops. The loop length is phylogenetic constrained as well. This is a domain of about 60 amino acids, and as you will see shortly, they're multi-domain proteins. Yes, sir? Right. Yes. No, they are controlling. They're controlling the gene expression of certain things, regulating in essence development. This is a picture of a homodimer, simply to give you a little bit more idea about the structure of the thing. It's a protein called Max that I'll talk a lot about later. This is the DNA binding region, as I said, alpha helix. There is some interaction here between the two helices, which I'll talk a lot about later. Not today though, tomorrow. This is this variable length loop. And this protein has both a second helix and a leucine zipper. And the leucine zipper functions to expand the dimerization region to simply lengthen for protein-protein interactions. These proteins are all highly modular. They all have this helix-loop-helix component, two alpha helices separated by a loop. Many of them have a basic DNA binding component, but not all of them, as I mentioned before. There are some that have a leucine zipper tacked on the end, but certainly not all of them. There are others that have a domain called a pass domain, which is another bipartite sort of domain that occurs the carboxy terminus of the helix. These are a lot of the signaling sorts of proteins. And some of them that I'll talk about today have what's called a SID region, which is an SIN co-repressor sort of domain that's involved with negative regulation on some other sorts of proteins. So there are lots of domains, and I haven't put anywhere near like all of them up here, but simply to give you some idea of the modular nature of these sorts of things, because this is very important to understanding how these things might have arisen and how they evolve. One thing that's quite important if you work with proteins, as all of you know, is to try and understand how you identify a group of proteins and how you classify unknown proteins into it. So there's all sorts of information that one might use. People use three-dimensional structural information, which is sort of the gold standard for classifying proteins. But most people use, one way or another, primary sequence similarity. And I'll talk a little bit about using some diagnostic patterns using very highly conserved amino acid sites. So the question that we have, of course, are what sort of elements would you use to very accurately identify what is a helix-loop-helix protein? If you're a multivariate statistician, this is a classic problem like you might find with discriminant analysis. Classic problem out of early history of psychiatry, for example, is people by various tests could identify schizophrenics and non-schizophrenics using some laboratory experimental sort of information. But rather than subject people to a battery of psychological tests, the question was, can we find other sorts of variables that will classify these individuals into the haves and the have-nots? And so you use physiological tests, behavioral tests, and so forth. It's very similar to what you would do with, potentially with proteins. You have a large number of amino acids in a protein, and you would like to be able to find some combination of amino acid sites which used simultaneously would allow you to, with a high degree of accuracy and being able to put a probability statement to it, to assign proteins into any number of groups. I would like to differentiate between helix turn helix and helix loop helix proteins, for example. They both have a set of alpha helices and a spacer region, and I would like to be able to identify these one way or the other. I'd like to be able to identify leucine zippers and so forth. And always do this at a certain level of probabilities. And in discriminant analysis, you can say, okay, there's a 70% probability that belongs to this group, 20% there, and 10%, and so forth. And it would be very nice to be able to do this with proteins. Unfortunately, there are difficulties with this, not the least of which is that proteins sequences that we work with use alphabetic symbols, and they have no natural ordering, no metric that underlies them. So that's a problem to begin with. The other problem that makes this, the discriminant analysis analogy more difficult, is discriminant analysis uses a variance-covariance matrix for each of the groups that you're involved with. So you have some idea about the relative variability and covariability among the elements. So measuring variability and covariability in proteins is a lot more difficult. What we do, since when we're working with sequence alphabetic symbols, is we use the Boltzmann-Shannon entropy from information theory to get information about diversity or variability, and we use this mutual information statistic, which is a covariance or correlation sort of thing. I'm not going to go into the algebra of this. We have several papers out that goes into this in some detail, and I'll be happy to tell you about it. But this is a picture showing an entropy profile of the 64 elements of a basic helix loop helix component. The higher the bar here tells you how much, the more variability, the more diversity, residue diversity that you see at a particular site. So this is the basic helix 1, loop helix 2 sorts of things. The theoretical maximum value here is about 4.32, since there are 20 amino acids here. But in many of these cases, there is very little variability in some of these amino acid sites. And we operated under the assumption that things that were very highly conserved are probably indicative of this particular class of proteins, and that we could use these to identify other sorts of helix-loop-helix things. These are always two basic residues. They're Ks or Rs. This site, in all of these things that bind DNA, that have a basic DNA binding region, is a glutamic acid. This is always a leucine. This is almost 400 proteins, and 98% of them have a leucine here at this site. So as you can see, there's a profile here that one might use to identify a helix-loop-helix protein. So what we did was to construct a 19-element, what we call predictive motif, that should identify helix-loop-helix protein. In statistics, this is sort of a goodness of fit algorithm. We've got sort of a linear equation up here, and we want to look at the goodness of fit of any unknown protein to this. So if it's an X, it's a K or an R. If it's an alpha, it's an aliphatic isoleucine, leucine, or valine. That's that glutamic acid. If it's an X with a subscript, this means it can be anything from 3 to 6 residues, or 3 here. This is the loop. And so it's anything from 5. We constrain this not to have the long yeast sequences and so forth. So what you have here is now sort of a linear equation that you want to look at the fit to this dysfunction. And I'll show you just a second precisely. What we use here is we're using this with a fuzzy logic algorithm using AGRIP, for example, to search a database to ask for the goodness of fit and defining it as so many mismatches. We look at all the proteins that deviate from this by one mismatch, by two mismatches, and so forth. Frequencies, you can do it that way. What has worked very well for us up to now is this AGRIP sort of search.
I know you don't want to go into it, but this is just a sub of P log P.
Yes.
Yeah. So when you do that, in terms of biases in the database, there's some type of whole length algorithm or whatever.
Yes.
And there's no correction for the underlying amino acid frequency.
We have not done that so far because, as you'll see, what we've done works exceedingly well. It's quite robust.
And so this is constructed by just looking at the data and saying, okay, what would make sense?
Walter and I did this. I mean, we didn't use any sort of a software program. We just simply stared at the data for a long time. And I tend, and I think Walter does too, to stare at data a lot, because I learn more about the biology of these things by simply sitting there for days or weeks at a time, staring at the alignment or whatever. And what comes out of this, and the reason that I like this, is that we have three-dimensional structure data for 6 or 8 of these proteins. And I can go in and tell you biological interpretations for most of these highly conserved site. That glutamic acid site, for example, is fundamentally important in a biological sense because it indicates whether that protein will bind DNA. There are others. Many of these things tend to be on the hydrophobic surface of an amphipathic helix. They're very highly conserved down on the hydrophobic surface. And so once you know the biology of these things become a lot more relevant. So the question becomes, how accurate is this particular motif? And all of the proteins that we used were experimentally known by any of several experimental sorts of analyses to be known helix-loop helix proteins. So I'll tell you a couple of exceptions in a little bit. But there were 111 sequences out of GenBank that fit this thing exactly. This was done a couple of years ago. There's about 230 sequences that fit it with up to one mismatch. That's one or zero, and then if you go up to two, you'll get about 300 and so forth. And with four mismatches in this thing, we got all the known helix-loop helix proteins and virtually nothing but the helix-loop helix proteins. There were two or three exceptions, and the exceptions turned out, as often is the case, exceptions are very important to teaching you something. There were three exceptions that were proteins that I didn't recognize as being helix-loop helix. So I went to the literature and looked at the proteins and found out they were proteins that interact with helix-loop helix. So it was telling me something about the fit of these things. So this has turned out to be quite useful as an approach, at least for the helix-loop helix, and we've tried it on helix-turn helix and a few other things. Yes, sir? Probably not a lot. I have run this on some of them, and it comes up with things that are reasonably similar. I mean, Walter and I just did a hand approach to these computer-based things. What can I say? I've noticed this too, and I don't know the answer to why it's doing this. It is fascinating, though. One of the things that's useful about this also, and the reason I like doing this, is I can go through and I can look at the sites that do vary, and it becomes important to see which sites, all this thing, are always obligatorily tied to whether or not something is a helix-loop helix, and which some of the sites that are a little noisy. If I was doing this all over again, I could do it even better, but I'm not sure the results would be all that much more robust.
Were all these sequences used in defining the motif, or were...
They were used initially they were used, all the sequences. Andreas Dress and I have gone back and done it by using some sort of weighting function, because many of these protein families are very well known, and there's a lot of sequences in the database for them. And so it will be weighted by the frequency of the sequences in a particular family. We weighted these things and tried it again, and the results are pretty similar.
Well, the reason I'm wondering is because there's always this question in terms of learning and memorizing. In other words, is this a pattern that learns the properties of these motifs, or is it something that memorizes known examples?
Yeah.
In terms of having a training set and a test.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now I assume you're talking about using hammer algorithms or something like that.
Right.
Because, well, Walter and I we learned a lot from doing this, but it wasn't in terms of the sequences. I mean, it was basically by just going through and looking at these entropy profiles.
No, but I'm wondering if you, for instance, took two-thirds of them, use that for establishing...
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah.
How well does that do on the cluster that you haven't used?
Exactly, and that's something that we are pursuing. We're looking more at the statistical aspects of how this thing works. Since we've got a large database that we know quite well, we've got these sorts of things, there are all sorts of tests we can do right now. But one of the things that we have been doing is doing so-called genome-wide surveys using this motif. And when we published the original paper, I guess it was in 98, I immediately jumped on the Drosophila stuff and found... You notice my name is not on here. And looked at a lot of interesting things, located a lot of different proteins, and then I set it aside because I wanted to work on something else. Someone else must have read the paper about the same time we did, because they had the same idea and went to work on the Drosophila database. It's a paper out of PNAS. And so they used my predicted motif and found 12 new helix-loop helix proteins that had not been reported yet by simply screening the genome. I should have gone ahead and finished that, but I didn't. But my group has now looked at the C. elegans database, and there are 25 new helix loop helix proteins there. The really interesting one is one of my PhD students has been looking at Arabidopsis and has found a very large number from our experience with everything else. There's 60 helix loop helix proteins in this, which is much larger than any other thing we found before. And the interesting thing about them is some of them are quite unusual. And there are proteins that I would not first blush recognize as being helix loop helix proteins because they have a very short second helix. And we are beginning to try and understand by structural analysis what these sorts of things are. That short second helix becomes very important in what I'll talk about at the end of the talk when I talk about this MCMAX network, because there is an intron that occurs in the second helix that separates that functional domain into a pretty short second alpha helix and everything else. And so it's suspicious as to for the transcription network that I'll talk about later. Yes, sir? I don't know what the total number is in here. It's this is about 40, and this is there are over 60 proteins out of the full genome of these things. Yes, we've added several. Well, it's hard to know what is already known to some people but not published, and what's known to me at least is 25 new ones that we added into this. And it's simply because we hadn't searched the C. elegans database to flesh out the full database, the working database that I have, because we're involved with doing structural sorts of things. But this made a nice opportunity to flesh out the database, and it simply told me a bunch of new ones. This told me a lot of new ones, some of which are structurally quite different. No. If it does, this guy is in trouble because he knows about this. And I go in every so often and say, "Are you writing the paper?" Oh yes, I'm writing. But I could, yeah. I've thought about doing that, but I would rather use this as a blunt instrument to get this guy to write his dissertation. Okay, let me. This is sort of my code to talk about phylogenetic trees that are difficult. This is a banyan tree, which you obviously have trouble knowing where the root really lies on this thing. And it's important to talk about helix loop helix with this banyanism as a model. Early on in this, I keep mentioning Walter because we do all these things together. We were working on several other groups of helix loop helix proteins, and so we decided to generate what we call a natural classification for the whole group. That is an evolutionary classification. So we want to do a phylogenetic analysis of the entire family. So we took about 60 of the residues that delimit the helix loop helix domain. We started out with almost 250 sequences. The trees got pretty difficult to deal with, so we pruned it down to about 120 sequences. We're using a neighbor joining algorithm that's bootstrapped, and the picture that I normally would show you is in the picture that's in PNAS collapses everything. But what I'll show you, this is sort of an evolution of the domain sort of thing. This is a much more schematic illustration. But out of the 250 sort of proteins that we used, these are the major functional families of things. Things like the MCMAX group, this is aerial hydrocarbons, this is the very well-known hairy proteins that people working in Drosophila enhancer split, atonal, more neurological sorts of things. So these are the major families of helix loop helix. This tree was rooted on this sequence called Delilah, which is plants. These are plants, these are yeast down to here except for that. So, but what the thing shows you is that there are several major groups within the family, what we call groups A, B, C, and D, and these refer to the way that these proteins bind DNA. There's a hexanucleotide binding site that where these proteins up here bind to an e-box with this configuration. These bind with a hexanucleotide with a e-box of this configuration, These guys don't bind. There's no DNA binding region. And then the so-called group C are the aryl hydrocarbons, and they dimerize with ARNT so that these don't bind DNA, but this does. So then there are other sorts of things. These proteins have this PASS domain that I'll talk a little bit more about in a second. So this is a nice sort of family tree, and what it does is it lays out in a very nice sort of way the functional groups of the helix loop helix proteins from an evolutionary perspective, because I'll show you another classification in just a second. I'm sorry? The largest difference? Well, you have to appreciate that this is only the helix loop helix domain, and so it's very highly conserved, 60 sites. And I think probably the most divergent has a P distance of probably between 70 and 80%. In other words, so there's 20 to 30% residues that are the same in a distance matrix like this. Let's get.
What's the distance?
I was simply using a percent. What was used here was this percent difference, P distance sort of thing, and I use that because it has a very low variance in terms of estimating the differences. I've used a Blossom 62 matrix. I've used a Jones-Taylor-Thornton substitution-based matrix. I've used a number of different ones, and they all come up with very similar sorts of answers. I sometimes think that distance metric selection is overrated in terms of if your data is good for building a tree. This gives you.
So at the beginning of the week, Paul Hicks gives this scenario where it transforms everything to time one. So there needs to be some variable in this tree.
Some variable in this. Well, you know, I could have drawn this out for you as an unrooted tree. I have not drawn anything with regard to branch lengths, because all I'm trying to do here is simply to show you something about the topology and the fact that there are groups. With trees of the size and complexity that I'm going to show today, it gets difficult when you start putting branch lengths and everything else on. And besides, many of the questions that I'm interested in right now that I'll be talking about are topological sorts of questions and not necessarily rate sorts of questions. Now, going back to these sorts of, yeah, they're negative regulators. They dimerize ID and extra macrochaetae and daughterless, or some of these are. But ID, which is inhibitor of differentiation, does not have a basic region, but it has an alpha. It has an helix loop helix, and it will dimerize with MyoD, for example, and prevent MyoD from binding DNA. They act as negative regulators. They simply prevent DNA binding.
Is the dimerizing
the place where MyoD normally binds? Well, it's simply dimerizing with the helix loop helix domain and preventing it from binding DNA. It just acts as a dominant negative effect. So here's what's sort of going on. These are these binding groups. These are the two E boxes, and then what are called groups C and D, which this is the aryl hydrocarbon group of proteins, and ID and extra macrochaetae, don't bind DNA. But there are a series of amino acid sites here that are quite diagnostic in terms of showing what sort of ways they bind DNA. So 5, 8, 9, 13, and 19. 9, you see there's always an E when they bind DNA and no E when they don't bind. But you can pick out quite nicely now these discriminating sites as to which sort of DNA binding pattern that you will find for these two groups, which are about 90% of the helix loop helix things. And this becomes a little bit important later when I talk about covariance relationships.
But A and B are monophyletic, right?
Good question. I'll come back to that.
The reason I'm wondering about is how much is there confounding of these type of relationships due to the evolutionary phylogenetic architecture?
Yeah. It's hard to know here for reasons that I'll actually talk about whether or not these things are all monophyletic in just a second. This is all based on the domain, the functional domain, and the functional domain probably itself is probably monophyletic. Whether or not the proteins contained within it are monophyletic is a very different sort of question.
Yeah, but I'm just wondering whether, yeah, for instance, these relationships here could be just due to, you know, chance evolutionary history, based on the fact that A and B are
Well, that's sort of indicative in the tree, but the tree then is based on the domain. It's a little bit circular in that regard. Yes. It basically just says that they're not involved, at least with determining an e-box. No, they're not. And it's just, B group is quite, well, these are all nice charged basic amino acids. And this combination is just simply very discriminatory, very diagnostic of the groups where these aren't, and these don't vary in any sort of pattern that will help. So doing something else at that site. Oh, sure, of course. Those are the discriminating sites that are doing this. Well, it's the way in the three-dimensional geometry of these things that these sites are approaching the half sites involved in the e-box. This, for example, this residue is the one that approaches the CA component here, and if that is not there, then none of the rest of this happens the way it's folded around on the thing. And it's simply involved in the geometry of how the protein is approaching the DNA, I think, in those half sites. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There is some three-dimensional X-ray crystallographic sorts of studies that help with the understanding of this. I didn't come prepared with the pictures to show you exactly how this works, but it's involved in the geometry of the way the things are actually able to approach the components in the two half sites. I don't think I can explain it much better without a picture. This is so the results out of the phylogenetic analyses are that there are about 24 separate paralogous lineages. They tend to reflect all the major groups, functional groups of these proteins. There are four DNA binding patterns that cluster out very nicely. The distribution in plants, animals, and yeast suggests it's been around a long time, which it has. The DNA, the helix-loop-helix domain, and the question that Richard was asking, gives you very good resolution at the tips of the clades. It gives you a poor resolution in the deep nodes. And it sort of suggests that the non-helix loop helix domain is such that it's very difficult to homologize between clades. And I'll come back to that in just a second. This is a classification that was recently published by two guys at University of San Diego in molecular and cell biology just a year or so ago. And it's a very different sort of classification. It's based on function of these things. And so they have seven or eight classes that are based on such things as whether or not protein has a leucine zipper, whether or not it binds to MYC or MAX, and so forth. Very non-phylogenetically based. And so what I've shown you here with arrows are their classes and where the proteins fall out on the tree. And so it's not a very predictive sort of classification. It's a very non-evolutionary sort of classification. And I put it up for just for comparison of how these things differ. Now, if I can come back to the question that Richard raised. Oh, the question is, if you have phylogenies based on this conserved helix-to-helix domain and you compare it to everything else in the protein, are the classifications concordant? And it relates back to our attempts to understand the deep node structure of these guys, because one of the original questions that I had when we started looking at these things was whether or not helix-loop-helix was a monophyletic group of proteins. I mean, can you take a nice little piece out of a protein and understand something about the evolution of the entire protein? I'm not going to, well, let me show you a picture that sort of, more than anything else, clarifies what's going on. This shows you the complexity and the position of the basic helix, loop helix, and some of the other things, and where they occur in a particular protein. This is a MyOD, it's a class A. It's one of the ones that always is identified by that predictive motif. It's a classic archetypal helix, loop helix protein. This is ID, so first thing you notice is it's lost the basic region. This is the protein max, it's added a leucine zipper. And then you get its dimerization partner, MYC. And what I want to show you, what this is intended to show you, is not only how many components are involved, but where they occur, the spatial orientation of the protein. So this is AP4, which is another helix-loop helix that has two leucine zippers now. And then these are these pass proteins, this helix-loop helix pass A, pass B, and you notice here the helix-loop helix is N-terminus, and here it's carboxyl terminus. So if you're doing alignment and you're trying to line these things up, you immediately see that you've got a problem in how you homologize, try to homologize the rest of the protein. This and this, these two proteins, as a two-sequence analysis, is a very good way, if you're teaching computational molecular biology, to show students about the frailties of alignment algorithms, because they are very obviously related, because they've got helix-loop-helix leucine zippers in both, but they're quite different in length. And things like Clustel have real trouble with this thing. And I often use this in class, tell students, I've explained to you how alignment algorithms work. Now let me show you an example that should just scare the hell out of you. Because what Clustel often does is it lays out MYC as the model and then starts dropping the residues in from Max to try and align it. And what happens is it usually stops somewhere up here, and this never even comes close to this. I've seen efforts at this with certain parameter settings where it's 100% wrong. And we all know the frailties of alignment algorithms, but this is a really good, simple two-sequence analysis to teach with. But what you see here is this problem of not only difference in protein length, but also spatial location of these conserved domains. Yeah, this is what correction by eye means in these things, in many of the algorithms. There's a whole lot of shuffling, and yeah, you have to, you can't take the solution out of the alignment programs, and you can. Well, on those two I'll show you precisely, because I'll show you much more detailed pictures. But in Max is little more than the helix-loop-helix leucine zipper. It's 150 residues long, and so it's a very simple little protein. MYC, on the other hand, has a transactivation domain that's been added. So coming back to this question about what does it take, you know, if you use the flanking and non-flanking regions, Burkhardt Morgenstern and I looked at this question about what sort of information about phylogeny is found in the what we call the flanking regions, the non-helix loop helix component. So the way we did this to get around the problem with spatial positioning of the conserved domain is we simply removed it and then concatenated the sequence elements and just made a long protein missing this conserved domain. And we used Burkhardt's dyeline program, which many of you are familiar with, set up a distance matrix, used various sort of clustering algorithms, and did sequence shuffling and all sorts of things that I won't go into, because what I want to do is tell you about the results. What we found was that you got clusters from the using only the flanking regions that were the same sorts of clusters that you got using only the helix-loop-helix with regard to the functional groups of proteins. It laid out all the functional groups as nice identifiable entities. And within the clades, both the helix-loop-helix domain and the flanking regions appeared to be monophyletic. They all seemed to have the same origin out of this. But the problem was that the similarity between clades for the flanking regions, except for some of the past proteins, was basically the same as you would see with random sequences. It was exceedingly difficult to try and align these things in any sort of meaningful way. And so what you would argue in this case is that these helix loop, helix domain containing proteins are not necessarily evolutionarily related. They are with regard to the functional domain, the helix loop helix, but the rest of them are so different as to basically appear to be random with respect to each other. So we sort of surmise that this was due to modular evolution. The evidence for that has to do with the picture that I showed you earlier on, the spatial orientation of the domain within the proteins, the fact that you can add and subtract domains reasonably easy in these, like the leucine zipper, the pass domain, the basic domain, some of the others. ID and extra macrochaetae have lost the DNA binding component. That suggests that you can shuffle things around. The pass domains have been added to some proteins. There we have evidence, pretty strong evidence these days, that these are degenerate direct repeats. But then there's a group of proteins called the period proteins that have the pass domain, but they have no helix loop helix. So all of these are sort of anecdotal evidence that there is some sort of modular evolution, domain shuffling, and so forth going on. I have not found this yet, but it's there are obviously proteins that have number of alpha helices with spacers in between them, but I haven't tried to find the helix loop helix thing. What we did in the predictive motif sort of thing is we simply searched for the two halves because the loop was so variable. We would search for the two components of that thing and then put them together, constraining the loop to be of a certain size. I have not looked for anything that had two helix loop helices. I suspicion they probably occur, but yes, sir. Oh yeah. If you put the flanking region and search it against.
Block out the helix loop helix. Mm-hmm. Search the flanking region against the database. What kind of a
hit? Oh, well, you'll of course get helix loop helix hits because.
No. You take out the helix loop helix.
I haven't done that You know, you'll find other groups of proteins. You'll find some of the other conserved domains that are in there. If you did it with the non helix loop helix and pardon me?
What are the flanking regions?
You'll find I'm not sure how to answer your question because you'll find almost anything if you take
what
the flank.
They
do any of a lot of things. I mean the MYC proteins, for example, that I'll show you. That's where the cell proliferation control is, and so there are many of these proteins have multiple functions, and so you'll find things out in the other regions that do a lot of these. The pass proteins, for example, they've got a helix loop helix that is at least a dimerization in some cases the DNA binding, but the pass domains are doing other sorts of things that are involved with signaling or dioxin. Metabolism or any of several sorts of things. So any other functions of the proteins you would find out in the flanking regions, and that's the sort of things that you would find with a database search with them. Exon shuffling will appear very strongly a little later in this talk when I start talking about one of the networks. Domain shuffling by exons will, yeah, of course. That's precisely what you would expect. I could stop here if everyone wants a break because I'm about to start talking about everything else. Okay, so let me talk for a little bit about another subject that I'm recently interested in and I think is going to be quite important if we understand protein evolution, and that's how these complex regulatory networks my proteins arise and how they evolve. I think everyone realizes that protein function has to involve interactions between proteins and other sorts of molecules. So what happens is that the proteins involved, or the proteins and their interaction partners, have to co-evolve so that the changes in one partner's binding surface are complemented at the interface by changes in their interaction partner. And if you don't have this complementation, you lose the interaction ability between the proteins. And so you need to think of these things often as co-evolving systems, but unfortunately the co-evolutionary relationships of interaction partners is not well understood at all. And there is a very important network of transcription factors called the MIC-MAX-MAD group. It's a reasonably small group of proteins, but it's a very important group. And the network is defined by a bunch of proteins that dimerize with this MAX protein. And the network functions in both transcriptional activation as well as transcriptional repression. The whole network is very fundamental in terms of its contribution to development, because it's involved in cell proliferation and apoptosis, which is programmed cell death, for those who don't know this term, and cell differentiation. And so this whole MIC network is truly fundamental to normal growth and development. And so, you know, people say, well, why do you study this? Well, the interesting thing about it is, because it's involved in cell proliferation, MIC is what's called a proto-oncogene. It's a cell proliferation gene, so therefore it's a gene that's potentially capable of causing cancer. Annually, there's about 70,000 cancer deaths in the United States that are associated with perturbation of this MIC expression. And for those of us who get our money from NIH, this is an important fact to know. And it's not that people have ignored the MIC protein. There's about 7,000 papers published on MIC. The interesting thing about them is, in spite of the 7,000 papers, the function of the protein is very poorly understood. The whole network is not well understood at all. So if you think about this cell proliferation, at least in an evolutionary concept, cell proliferation in animals is very tightly regulated, obviously, and subject to very strong natural selection. Because if you perturbate a cell proliferation cycle, it causes all sorts of chaos in development. For example, if we look at this MIC protein, these are ways to perturbate the thing. If you get changes in amplification where you increase the amount of the MIC protein, there's a lot of experimental evidence that says a lot of different sorts of carcinomas result. Various sorts of viral introductions or transductions also deregulate MIC. This is how you get a lot of the cancers. In this particular case, the retroviral things are feline and bird cancer. If you get translocations involving the MIC expression, you deregulate it. You get something, a well-known phenotype known as Burkitt's lymphoma, and several other of these things as well. So it's a very important network to understand how it operates and how it might have arisen. The MIC and MAX genes have been found in flies and worms and a few other things, sea urchins and sea stars. It doesn't occur in yeast, fungi, plants, Arabidopsis, anything. We've looked very carefully at these things, searched them very strongly, and have not found this thing anywhere. But at least it occurs in flies and in nematodes, so we have experimental systems to work with in that regard. The way the system works is sort of like this. This is a summary of the network. MAX is sort of key to this, and the network, as I said, was defined by all the proteins interacting with MAX. MIC heterodimerizes with MAX to stimulate transcription and stimulate cell proliferation. MAD and MINT and MEGA and a few of these others are known as MIC antagonists, so that the heterodimerization with MAX represses transcription and promotes terminal differentiation. Likewise with these others, they're transcriptional regulators, they're transcription suppressors. There is another protein, a new protein that's been discovered called MAX-like. It will also interact with MAD. So everything sort of focuses around MAX. And so what we are trying to do is to understand the evolution of this network, and also how it might have arisen, how the transcription, how a network, and not just a single protein, but how a network of interacting proteins arises. Yeah, Walter.
I didn't get how does MAX-like interact
It heterodimerizes with MAD. This is a new protein that is... It's, well, let me, there's only one paper that I know of that really discusses this thing. It's very new, and the whole physiology of this thing is not well understood at all. Yeah, well, I know. I should probably change this to just say transcriptional regulation, because I'm not sure it's repression, and it's not clear from the paper that, that that's the case.
What was your question?
Well, he's... Well, I should point out that the relevance is not to here, but the relevance is to here. Because the way this thing works, it's like a competitive allocation of resources model. The amount of max is reasonably constant in the cell, even a differentiating cell. And so if it's taken up with dimers here, then you'll get transcription. But so if MYC is upregulated, because this you'll get transcription, if it's downregulated and MAD is upregulated, it's using the same max level that would have been used here. It's just taking max away from MYC. And so that's why I say the relationship here is probably over there and not to here. It's whether or not this thing will heterodimerize with MYC.
Well, if it doesn't heterodimerize with MAD, does that prevent
I don't know the answer to that. This is a cottage industry, of course, discovering these sort of proteins. And but this is sort of the way the network works right now. And so the fundamental question is not only how do these things all interact, but how did they arise? What's the chicken and what's the egg in this thing? Yeah.
So Max is the one that binds the DNA.
Well, yeah, they bind, the heterodimers bind it to an e-box, yes. Yeah. This binds, but this is transcriptionally inert. It doesn't seem to bind. And that's sort of a key to all this. This is the only one, as you'll see that homodimerizes. It's the only one that will dimerize with itself. MYC, MAD, MINT, MEGA will not homodimerize. This one does. It, that's right. It's transcriptionally inert.
Oh, but the L case, so the Max and MAD, all those things do bind to DNA.
Yes, yes,
okay.
Yes.
Just that they're, okay, so their role is more than just preventing MYC.
Oh, yes, yes, that's right. It's the...
Okay, so MAD, MYC, they also bind to DNA, and, well, together they bind to DNA, or by itself, MAD...
As heterodimers, yeah.
So they're both actually physically tested.
I think that's right, yeah. What is signaling to Max? A good question, and I'm not sure I know the answer to this. They're either growth factors or other signaling molecules from outside.
And all these things bind four separate binding sites in the DNA?
Good question, and I don't know the answer to that. Yeah, you were going to ask the same question.
I was going to ask
I don't know the answer to that. Yeah, yeah. There are two new reviews that summarize basically everything that's known about these things, an annual review and a couple of other places. But there's the network is not well understood, you know, in spite of all the work that's been done on it.
When you say enhances or represses the transcription, is it always the case, or depends on where the binding site?
Well, I mean, if you upregulate MYC, it stimulates transcription. You downregulate MYC, you get cell differentiation going on here. And this is the switch that's going on here between growth and differentiation. And so the amount of max in the cell is pretty constant. It's whether or not you upregulate MYC or MAD or some of these other things down here as to which way it kicks it off. And some of these are much more tissue specific sorts of things. MAD is well, several of these, this one and I think this one as well, are very suspect in being tumor suppressors because of the way they interact back up here. And so there's a lot of research right now looking at the tumor suppressor activities of here, but it's because they're acting as antagonists to MYC.
And it's the competition for MAX that makes it a switch.
Yes, yes.
Because if you just have things responding to MAD or something.
Yeah, it appears to be a classic competitive allocation. It's like a competitive allocation of resources model, that there's a constant amount of this, and it's what goes on here. But obviously, that's too simple of an argument, because you've got to have extrinsic stimulators of these things.
Is
because none of the others will homodimerize. They only function, MYC only functions through the interaction with MAX. MAD only functions through the interactions. The thing that's common to all of them is this.
Because MAD turns off MYC. Because if you have a lot more MAD, not only do you have MAD binding, but MAD is binding also to MAX.
Yeah.
There's less MAX for MYC, and MYC's turned off.
Okay.
So MAX is the switch.
MAD turns off by pulling MAX.
But
there's something more profound here, because in this particular study, MAX is always the problem. But MYC and MAD, in general terms, could in principle diverge with something else as well. So MAD by combinatorics of a new component.
Yeah. There are other proteins involved with this. They're just not described or well involved. And the network is more complex than what I'm showing you here, because there are other things that interact with this guy. So there's other ways to suppress this system than. But this is the pretty much the basic a large component to the control of cell cycle in animals, at least in higher animals. So the cast of characters for MYC, as I said, it regulates cell growth, apoptosis, and transformation. There are at least five groups of proteins involved. There's cMYC, which is the cellular MYC. It's the homolog to the viral MYC, so-called vMYC. LMYC is a lung carcinoma sort of. It's involved. It was detected in a number of lung carcinomas. This is a neuroblastoma MYC. It's a neural MYC. This is a variant that's not well studied, and BMYC is a MYC that has the transactivation region but no helix. And so MAX dimerizes with MYC and MAD. MAC is an antagonist. There are several versions of MAD, MAD1, this is MAD2, 3, and 4, and then these other guys that I haven't said much because they're just not well studied. But here's sort of what the network looks like from a different sort of perspective. The key ingredients here again are MYC and MAX. If they heterodimerize, they bind to this E-box, and you get the activation of transcription. This is MAX over here. It can homodimerize, or it can heterodimerize with all of these guys. These sorts of heterodimerizations then incorporate a co-repressor molecule that's called SYN, and it blocks this transcription. There are other things that heterodimerize with the helix-loop-helix part of MYC. This is called yin-yang 1 and some other sorts of things, and they repress transcription. So it's a complex network. It's one that's going to be really intriguing to try to model in a mathematical sense. Some of the properties of MYC, you've already seen that it does here. This protein is about 440 amino acids long. It has two introns, one in the coding region, one outside the coding region. There's a transactivation domain that's amino acids 1 through 143 that's responsible for gene activation. This transactivation domain contains two exceedingly highly conserved regions that are called MYC homology boxes. They influence transcription, and those boxes interact with another group of proteins. These are exceedingly highly conserved from flies all the way to humans. MYC is involved, as I'll show you in a second, with at least two separate interaction networks. MYC homodimerizes poorly. It has to interact with MAX to function. And so this is a schematic of what a MYC protein looks like. This is the transactivation region down to here. These are these two MYC boxes. These are phosphorylation regions. It's an acidic domain. This is the nuclear localization signal. And then here's basic helix loop helix. And as I said, there are two networks involved. There's this group of proteins that interact with the N-terminus part of MYC, and they're these that interact with the carboxy terminus, like Max with the helix loop, helix, and so forth. So there's a lot of things going on here. So with Terry's question about, you know, a simple explanation, no, it's not simple, because I haven't tried to take into account all of these other proteins as well. So it's becoming a very complex system. I'm showing the position of introns here, because I'll talk about them quite a bit here, in this with a double-headed arrow. Now, I don't know what's gone on before in terms of explanations or where this is needed, but since I'm going to use the word intron a lot in a minute, let me throw this in. Intron obviously is an intervening sequence. It's some DNA that's transcribed but then removed by RNA splicing. They distinguish things that we call exons, which are segments, and I'm interested in them because they often correspond to distinct modules in a protein. And there is a process called exon shuffling, which is the incorporation of exons into different proteins. Exon-intron interactions are the subject of a lot of controversy in evolutionary biology, which I don't want to get into at all, because I don't want to talk about introns early and late and all of that. But it's a very controversial subject in some areas. So here's what Max looks like. Max is a little short protein. Paul showed pictures of primates. I'm showing pictures of proteins. So yours were more interesting than mine. 150 residues long. It's an obligate dimer to all of the proteins involved in this network. It's involved. It's required for MYC function. It's present in all cell types at near constant levels during cell differentiation. So that means that it's not going up and down. The amount is constant, and so it's being allocated to other sorts of interactions. The number of introns range from 1 in humans to at least 4 in flies and chickens. It readily homodimerizes. It has this N-terminus acidic region. Nuclear localization signal is somewhere in here, and then it has the helix loop helix. What you see with these intron insertions, and what I want to show you on several of these, is that the intron insertion points are very conspicuously associated with the starts and stops of functional domains in these proteins. And so when you want to talk about how these things might have arisen and evolved, the putative relationship of these intron insertions are become quite important. What it means is it's isolating the exons out so they can be moved around a lot easier. There are a number of splice variants associated with this thing that have various functions, so that there's a lot of variability in the Max protein itself. This gives you some idea of the amount of sequence conservation that occurs in Max. This is humans, Drosophila, and C. elegans. This is a P distance relationship, that's percent difference. So between humans and flies, the percent difference of about 48%. Between Drosophila and worms, it's about 60%. This is a very highly conserved little protein over a lot of geological time. And this marks the basic helix 1 loop, helix 2 leucine zipper. So you can see that there's a great deal of conservation involved here if you simply look at the colors. Well, they occur as heptad repeats, so it's every seventh. And there's some pretty hinky definitions as to what's a leucine zipper. I have a very conservative definition. It's either a leucine or an isoleucine. There are other people who vary significantly from that. Here's something that shows you a little bit about the relationship about number of introns and sequence similarity. This is human and Max chick. There are 4 intron insertions in chick. There's only 1 in humans. But you see by the capital letters here that at least in the helix loop helix, they're identical. So that they're interesting relationship between the amount of divergence. And all of this, of course, becomes important in terms of evolutionary models. This just simply shows you some of the isoforms of Max, the fact that Max is going to have variability in the system that you might evolve another system from. The MAD family includes the proteins that I showed you before. It heterodimerizes with Max, binds to the E-box, it functions as a transcriptional repressor. It's upregulated during cell differentiation. This is where this co-repressor SYN3 comes in, because there's a syn interaction domain, as you'll see in a second. Again, it's a multi-domain protein with multiple introns. This is one of the MAD proteins. This is MAD2. What I want to show you here is it's another short protein with a number of introns. The introns, this one separates out the SID region, this co-repressor, basic helix loop helix. So the introns are positioned very close to, in most cases, to the boundaries of the functional domains. This is MAD1, another member of the MAD family. You see the same sort of thing. There won't be a test on this. I simply want to show you the tree. This is a neighbor joining tree. It's rooted on Max and C. elegans based on my assumption that, as you'll see shortly, that the protein Max is where the whole complex originated. It's the progenitor protein from this. C. elegans is the most primitive organism in that group. But you see Max. Here's the MAD. These are the Max interactors. And then here are the three MIX. Deep in the MIC tree is Drosophila. These points are the places where we have estimated ancestral sequences. The obvious reason for estimating ancestral sequences is I want to understand more about the evolution of the structure of these things based on their sequences. And also, we are synthesizing these proteins, the ancestral proteins, in the lab so we can study their function, to see how we might get functional differentiation among some of these lineages. Ancestral means original, origin. Well, it's consensus at that node, I guess, is one way to look at it. It's the sequence that is the progenitor sequence at that particular node. No, yeah. Thanks.
Why do you think you could get successful sequences, but it's function maybe the things that you
we're gonna try. this may be a lark, but we're certainly gonna try it. You know, when students come to you and say, what should I work on for my dissertation? You can say, we're going to roll the dice here, and it may work, and you'll be famous. It may not work, and you'll be discouraged. one of the questions, yeah.
How do you deal with that?
I haven't approached that yet, and it may be that I go back to some of the deeper sequences in the node and make decisions based on that. There are ambiguities in there, and that's what I haven't resolved yet. There is experimental, obviously, alternate ways to deal with that. If you recall the picture of MIC that I showed you, there's a transactivation region that's up 140 residue, 140 sites at the N-terminus, and then there's the helix loop helix at the other end. And I will propose a little bit later on that MIC is actually a composite protein, that it got the helix loop helix from one source and transactivation region from another. And so one question that one might ask then, of course, is whether or not the patterns of evolutionary divergence between those pieces are concordant, whether or not they fit to that tree. And this is something that I generated the other night. This is all very recent work, and I'm here to talk to Walter about it all. But this is the tree from the transactivation domain. It's rooted on Drosophila MIC here. And this is a neighbor-joining tree of the helix loop helix domain that's, again, rooted on MIC. There are some things that are not the same in here because, for example, Amphioxus, the sequence only exists for the transactivation domain. I didn't do this. BMIC has no helix loop helix in it. And so they're not identical. But what this shows is that basically the trees are quite similar. And the only place where there is some possible conflict has to do with the MIC for sea star and sea urchin, but that's a 58%. This is a trifurcation, and that's pretty dicey down there, so I don't want to speculate a lot about it. Obviously, this is something that needs to have much more robust sorts of tree building. Well, basically, yes, stare at it close. One of the things that one obviously needs to do is to do some maximum likelihood things on here to test the concordance of the trees. This was generated only a few days ago. I haven't done that yet. But basically looking at the topology of the trees, I mean, where clades originate and their sequential organization and so forth, the trees look pretty similar. And like I say, it's only in here that it's very suspect. It looks like there's pretty strong concordance in the evolution of the transactivation domain and the dimerization and binding region. But I can't give you a probability number right now for that.
If you were to ask the question, how many nearest neighbor branch swaps would it take to get one to the other, allowing for the fact that you've got lots of that contiguous ordering up there, it's still very, very hard. Maybe
I was just asking a very low-level question.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's called Atchley's eyeball test. I can't give you a probability level for the eyeball test, but they look similar. That's.
Is there any one existing algorithm for comparing trees?
Pardon me? Eyeball is probably as good as most. Yeah. Yeah.
Are the number of branches that have to collapse and then we separate and it's a very simple algorithm, but it increases exponentially from going at one necessarily to two or three. It's unambiguous and it's useful for things that are closely related to the The other one that's been proposed is nearest neighbor branch image changes. And that can jump to you and you can think about it right away. But you've got a system that sort of paints these things with different colors and that helps you get the actual number an actual number out, which is
But the comparison of these trees, I noticed that the branches seem to be speciation rather than gene duplication. The things seem to fit the organism tree. So it seems like that one interpretation is these trees are very similar. The other is that both of these are very similar to the organism tree.
Mm-hmm.
And that induces a similar.
Yeah. I haven't tried to flip nodes around and things like that to make these even better because sitting in a hotel room doing these is not as good as sitting at home on a bigger machine. So, but anyway, right now it looks, it's a first order approximation that the evolutionary divergence in the transactivation region is pretty close to those same patterns that you see in the DNA binding and dimerization regions. That's what it's, they at least evolved in parallel. They may have been subjected to the same selection pressures and so forth. They evolved in parallel. It depends on whether or not you want to accept my explanation as to how MYC arose. If it arose as a fusion between something that brought you the helix-loop-helix and something that brought you the transactivation region, and there's still some stuff in the middle, and it's some sort of a fusion protein like that, then that's one set of explanations that you would use as opposed to the fact that the protein was a whole.
But the thing is, if these are real orthologs, I don't know how to interpret the meaningfulness of a similar tree.
Yeah.
There's a lot of parallels in there. Just count how many times you see red.
Oh, but they're relatively late, for instance. I mean, I noticed it seems like the similarity between the DNA and the other biologists. The similarity between this and the organism is about as similar as the two trees are to each other. I mean, like,
like all the apes are together, all the cats are together, the fish are together.
It's more likely, even if all the C's, looking at the first letter, all the C's are together, all the L's are together, all the N's are together, and all the S's are together. All of those different proteins which you saw in his max pattern interaction with all these other things, they all fall out as monophyletic functional groups.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. So, and they do on both.
So in other words, it's really the so if we sort of say, okay, speciation, 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 what you're really saying is that the phylogenetic relationships between the first letters are the same. I mean, that's the important
which thing. which relate to function.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Thanks.
Okay. So to go back to this question about whether or not proteins co-evolve, there are at least, well, there are a couple of scenarios that I might pose to you. In one scenario, natural selection reinforces this complementary sequence change between interacting proteins, where you would have approximately the same amount of sequence divergence, sequence diversity, between pairs of proteins. There's another scenario that says natural selection constrains sequence variability in one partner to maintain some sort of a canonical structure that it binds to, that will bind to everything else. So it's low sequence diversity in one pair that allows everything else to change. I mean, those are two reasonable reasonable scenarios, because one involves parallel change and one just simply says we're going to keep something very simple, and you can play around with everything else, but you can't change the one in the middle. And so the evidence on this looks like this, and it's sort of preliminary. This is something about the average number of changes, differences, changes in the various proteins. Max, this is, I had a sample size of about 11 sequences, 22, so forth and so on of these others. And so max doesn't change very much at all. These are the vertebrate sequences now. The number increases as you go, if you include all the invertebrates, but the explanation does not change. So then you go through and you look at all of those where their mic and max occur in the same organism, and you get the same sort of relationship. This number doesn't count, but basically it's the same thing, that max varies very little and these others vary much more. So if you go back to the picture that I showed you very early that showed the interaction domain showing you max in the middle, then max is being very highly conserved and everything else is playing around it. So do proteins co-evolve? Yeah, they have to do this, and this is one of the scenarios that... So let me sort of conclude all this with an explanation as to right now how I think the network arose. And we look at the role of Max in this. I think it's the putative progenitor for the whole complex, and the explanations follow that. It's the dimerization partner of all the network proteins. None of the others can function without Max, so it had to be there pretty early. It's the only homodimerizing one. It's the simplest one in terms of its components and domains. There are several variants and isoforms that could have been involved in its origin. The functional domains are quite well delimited by introns that would facilitate domain shuffling. We did that. There, and if you wonder where Max might have come from, there are a number of other helix-loop-helix clades that contain proteins that are very small, that are contain either basic helix loop helix or just simply, in the case of ID, helix loop helix, no basic region. So the original material from which this might have arisen has been there, I think, for quite a while. And the one of the pictures, and I didn't go into it in a lot of detail, showed an intron in the second alpha helix, very early in the second alpha helix, and that looks very much like some of the Rabidopsis things that we found that looked sort of hinky based on what I know about helix loop helix. It had a regular helix loop and a very short second helix, much like what you would expect here. And of course, leucine zippers, which occur in all these, could very easily have been derived independently, and I've looked at this, and that's really true. If you look at intron variation, here's what Max looks like in flies and in chickens, very highly conserved. There are these four intron sites. Here's this little intron that I was talking about that split the helix up. This is one of the worm forms of Max in humans. It has only one intron. This is what human MYC looks like. It has only a single intron there. So you can extrapolate this to here. This is actually stuck in here. And then this is this, and you have this. There is a version of MYC that occurs in woodchucks that has no introns. So intronic variation gets interesting in here. And there is another worm version of this that has three introns. Yes, I think so.
How long are the introns?
I don't know the answer to that right now. I've simply been looking to put them in. I haven't drawn the actual shape of the protein out. So with regard to MYC, I think MYC had a composite origin. The helix-loop-helix acidic region, the nuclear localization signal is derived from MAX. The transactivation domain, which includes the MYC boxes, came from somewhere else. I don't know where yet. The transactivation domain origin occurred very early because it's very highly conserved, particularly the MYC boxes, from flies to humans. The MYC boxes are almost the same. MYC homodimerizes very poorly. It can't exist, do much on its own, and it's only expressed as a heterodimer. And finally, the MAD group, which is the MYC antagonist, may have been derived from MAX because all you have to do is to add at the N-terminus this little syn interaction domain. Again, all the components are delimited by introns, making shuffling easy. Dimerizes, homodimerizes poorly, and it functions as a negative regulator for MYC, and so there's no reason for it to occur if MYC wasn't around.
Why doesn't MYC
heterodimerize with MAD? I don't know. I'm not sure what it would do because MAD is the antagonist, and so I guess you could cut out the middleman, so to speak, and bind directly. I don't know the answer to this. It's sheer speculation.
So is there evidence for the idea that MAX originated first?
Not the circumstantial evidence that I'm showing you here. I don't know any other evidence right now. There may be in terms of delving deeply into some of the molecular biology literature for some of the experiments that's been done. David. Yes. There's probably a pretty damn strong selection to prevent it. Someone had a question over here? Not that I'm aware of. Somebody else may be aware of it, but I'm not. In this case, it's looking for the most parsimonious explanation to explain the rise of an interacting group of proteins. And yes.
So there's no way of doing the phylogenetic relationship with an other outgroup that's further away than MAD MYC for our...
Well, there are other networks that are like this in helix-loop-helix. Some of the AKT-skute proteins, the ones that are involved with neurogenesis, undergo a lot this sort of interaction network. The MyoD proteins do to some degree. There are extrinsic ways to test this with other groups of proteins in helix-loop-helix to see if it's a domain shuffling intron insertion sort of thing.
Well, I'm just wondering, I mean, the phylogenetic tree, you used MAX to root the tree.
So yes, well, that's, of course, stuff. Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if you could root it with something else, then you could...
I've tried that. I've tried that, and it's a little too far away right now, so... Well, there's only one protein out of this that will interact with itself, and that's MAX.
The key is
yes. None of the other proteins will function if they homodimerize. They homodimerize very poorly, and as a result, they simply don't function. I don't know the answer to that, but the statement that you made about this is a parsimony model. It is. It's looking for, you know, the most direct ways of using multiple lines of evidence to do this. And I'm sort of swayed by the very close correspondence between the intron insertion points and the functional domains and so forth. It makes a reasonably straightforward explanation for this.
It's interesting though, because Max by itself doesn't have a function.
That's right. MIC doesn't operate by itself, and Max can't operate with itself.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that there's a key there that
MAD can't operate by itself.
No, MAD doesn't homodimerize, doesn't do anything by itself. So the key, I think, is what Max does by itself. I mean, at least homodimerizes. It currently doesn't have a function. Now, the fact that these things, it has a function and it functions with MIC. There are other groups of helix-loop-helix proteins where this question can also be explored. I just haven't done it yet. You know, these sorts of very small proteins.
What's the function of Max? It has none of what
they do in Max. Well, it may very well have arisen as through a domain shuffling from some other protein that had other functions. I mean, there is ID, and ID looks very much like Max. It's even more stripped down. It doesn't have a basic region. It functions as a negative regulator. Since it doesn't have a binding DNA binding region, it simply prevents DNA binding and everything else. Maybe Max arose from something like ID with the addition of a basic region. The basic region here is very common. This sort of E-box is very common in many other proteins. Basic zippers, zinc finger, some of the zinc finger proteins have this sort of E-box. It's called a G-box in plants. It's all very similar. So there are ways to, I think, to pick this thing up. Yeah, Terry.
This kind of a scenario can extend it to multiple protein interactions. So either it's A homodimer itself,
sure. Well, it can be done. I'm not sure how far the network can get extended. It's very obvious that it could. We have that same possibility here because MIC interacts with a lot of other proteins that I haven't talked about here. Yes, yes, yes. It interacts with things that I haven't even entered into this complex. I'm sure they have. I'm just not aware in great detail of it. Yeah.
I can tell
lots of stories.
MIC or MAD were there first. And
yep.
It did homodimerize.
Yes.
But lost it.
That's right.
Yes.
Yes. So yes. Oh, of course. There's a reciprocal explanation here. Yeah. Yep. Yep. Oh, yeah. I can do the 1/Max origin probably just as easily. It just, from the other sorts of evidence, I think it's this way, but...
I mean, there's another question whether these other things that don't homodimerize, do they not bind because they don't homodimerize, or are these two things separate? If you were to put them together, then you would induce dimerization, and the question is whether there's any residual, and since DNA block binding in the tethered homodimer.
Well, the whole homodimerization phenomenon is very intriguing, because there are isoforms and there are variations on these things that seem to homodimerize more easily than others. And I'll talk tomorrow about covariance relationships. And one of the things that I would really like to find is looking over the entire distribution of helix-loop-helix proteins. There are a lot of them that homodimerize and a bunch of them that don't, is to find out if there's any relationship between sequence composition and the ability to homodimerize or not homodimerize. And there are all these extrinsic sort of explanations that it would be nice to know about that may have a structural explanation that we can come back to on this.
It seems the intron locations and things like that cannot be used to justify one particular scenario or the other. Because again, that's a parsimony.
Yeah.
Sure.
Sure. It's you know, the presence of these things, the multiple nature, the fact they occurred near boundaries, it's just all very suspicious. And this is today's thinking about this.
Yeah.
This is all very new work, I should point out. This is not something that I've spent a great deal of time mulling over.
So Ron and I will ask him the same question. So. Like the what claims we have scenarios, because the key piece would be that the vaporization is difficult to get, so you use that to derive anything. But if that's difficult to get, then presumably then it's difficult to get the first dimer in the first place, and that it would be even more difficult to get the homodimer than natural dimer.
Well, this explanation can't exist on its own with only these. I've got to have something that generates max. And I haven't, just simply haven't gone that far yet. There are, the reason I showed the picture of the number of isoforms and splice variants and so forth of max is they also have different functions. And they do a little bit different things. And so what I need to do right now is to explore the variability in max a lot more. I mean, it's highly conserved, but some of the variability that you see there has pretty significant application to this in terms of what those variants do.
So how hard is generically, say, for nature to tweak the amino acids to have protein bind, two proteins bind closely?
I think that that's a trivial thing for nature. And I argue on the following basis that actually, first of all, upon monomers that mineralization in order to get a crystal. And everything that's done actually, there's a lot of it done, these things have gotten together, not in pairs, but in many, many things. If they can do that, then it would seem to me that it will be trivial to find among the many something that will serve your function or something.
There
are some proteins they haven't done the X-ray crystallography on because they can't get them, to, even though they have a high concentration saturated solution, they can't get them.
Okay, but if it's very easy to find partner, then why bother?
Carrie, there's another.
So sure, they probably contact 1,000 other proteins themselves. But those proteins don't have DNA binding to me, or they don't have transcription factor.
But that's by itself, it doesn't bind.
But Max has many, many other functions, right? It has hundreds of functions, like the one you showed.
There are also a number of scenarios that have been explored by David Eisenberg. One of them involves domain swapping, where you have a region of the protein that binds to itself, and then it's very easy to switch units around, and the binding site there is already specified. The other is that these things could have evolved from something that is a single molecule, that it's, and was therefore able to bind rather easily, and then there's some type of event which separated them out. And that was actually used as a way of figuring out of which interact with each other by what used to, or what where there's evidence that these are sometimes together a single molecule. Those are other sort of interesting scenarios.
I put this up to sort of acknowledge my colleagues. This is the so-called gang of six that's been involved in this helix-loop-helix work. My German colleagues, Andreas Dress, Burkhard Morgenstern, and Werner Trehal, Walter, and myself, and Kurt Wollenberg, who's one of my recent postdocs. And if you're interested in reading more about this, a lot of these papers are up on my website as PDF files, and some of the stuff that went into this. They'll be up as PDF files until some editor comes and steps on my throat and tells me not. I can't do that. Yes, yes, yes. It also shows I'm a musician. Good. Thank you very much.